Hello, and welcome to Keep Calm and Choir On, a podcast about the power of singing together. My name is Ryan LaBoy, and I'm thrilled to be here today to launch our new podcast with one of my most favorite people in the entire world, Dr. Deborah Simpkin King. Deborah is a choral conductor, new music advocate, and master teacher based in New York City, and we are so thrilled to chat with her this morning. And Deborah, thanks for being here to spend some time with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure and privilege.
As you know, and I'll share with our audience who's listening to our podcast, the interview questions that you and I are going to go through today are based on what I know of you and the now, what is it, decade of relationship that you and I have together. Can you imagine that?
At least that, yes.
Yeah, it's incredible. But also, we have interview questions that are compiled by my students at North Hennepin Community College, who have read through your biography and all of the additional information you provided us, whether it's a link to your personal website or the various ensembles that you work for. And so they've also created some interview questions that I think are really extraordinary and insightful. And I'm super excited to dig into those with you.
Great.
So why don't we just jump right in and see how this goes?
Let's go for it.
All right. So our first question is going to come from one of my students named Claire. And I'm going to first read a quote from your bio. You said, "Even now, when people ask me about my career in music, I can only respond that it is not a career as one might usually consider. It is very simply who I am." And Claire asks, based off of that statement, why do you define music as who you are? Can you share a bit about that?
I agree with you. I think it's a great question. All I can say is that to me, it feels like more than what I do. Everything that I express, I feel first through music. I'm unable actually to separate it from other parts of life. It permeates my sleeping as well as my waking. It certainly is what I am here to do. It's what I delight in doing. I feel that through music, we have the privilege of nurturing others. And that's a big part of who I am and what I feel I'm called to do in this life. Maybe in the next life, it'll be different. But in this one, it's music.
Yeah, and I think that makes me think of the concept of vocation, right? And how vocation, we can separate out from what we do for work and what we feel called to this earth to do. And so I would venture to say that you feel a vocational call to serve this world as a musician. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
So knowing we have a number of students listening to the show, can you talk to us about how you became the purpose-driven musician you are? I mean, according to the bio you sent along for my students, we know that you yourself had questions about whether or not you would be a practicing musician or if you felt you were being called to ministry. Mm-hmm. How did you discern between studying ministry and studying music and ultimately choosing music as your path?
Well, it was, I guess, late teens, early 20s. I was in my undergraduate years, and I guess I probably would have been described as somewhat of a serious young person. I certainly took it very seriously that I was on this earth for some reason, and I needed to kind of figure out what that was. And faith had always been central to who I, or for many years had been central to who I am. And so it made sense to me that I look at a call to ministry. And ultimately, I prayed through it, and ultimately came to the conclusion that I was indeed call to ministry, but that music was my vehicle, not the spoken word. And that's not to say that it's a sectarian or even necessarily a religious use of music. Sometimes it is, and sometimes it's in a secular arena. I do a lot more work in the secular arena than I do the church at this point. But to me, it's all about nurturing who we are as individuals and connecting us with the greater reality, you know, whatever we want to call that, whether it's the unity that we share as all part of the human species and the human journey, whether it's our connection with different cultures and even with the earth, or for some of us, that takes on a spirituality, but it's about nurturing the human condition.
You know, what I hear you saying actually reminds me of a question that another one of my students asked. And so okay. I'll sort of loop this into our conversation. This question comes from Brittany, and she says, do you think choral music brings a sense of community more than other types of music performance? And I'm going to extend that to say more than other types of communal gatherings. What do you think?
You know, in a way, that's asking, do I think my baby's more beautiful than yours? I mean, it's, you know.
But it is.
Well, yeah. You know, choral music is kind of, you know, that's where I live. So, of course, I would answer, yes, Brittany, I do. On the other hand, I do think that there are some things that make choral music rather given to building community. One is that sense of spirit or breath. It's a breath-based instrument. Yeah, okay, so is the flute, no doubt about it. But sure. There is a, you know, in many languages, breath and spirit, you know, spri is the same word. And I think there's something to that. We share our breath, we share our essence when we come together to make music. The choral art is somewhat unique in that it can encompass such a broad spectrum of experience and expertise, frankly. You know, somebody who can carry a tune and doesn't know a lot more than that about music can have a grand experience singing with others, and we can call that a choir. Other choirs, you can have all multiply degreed singers and, you know, a very high level of art that is the same sort of experience you would have with a symphony orchestra. And all of that, you know, I think the coming together across the spectrum of so many different levels of experience is part of what draws a broad community together. So that's another reason I do think that this baby is pretty beautiful.
What I hear you saying makes me think of the fact that choir is this great social equalizer. Right? It's democracy in action. It doesn't matter how old or how young you are, how much money you have in your wallet, how light or how dark your skin is, how tall or how short. Nothing matters when it comes to participating in a choir other than being willing to take that journey inside of yourself and offer it to a community with sincerity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, it's such a beautiful thing. I truly, no insult meant to my colleagues who direct or play in bands or orchestras, but it's just you coming as you are with all of the story and life that you've gathered and being brave enough to dig inside and share it with the world. And it's just this really awesome, incredible thing. And I saw that so beautifully enacted as I sang with you in New Jersey for a number of seasons. Then the ensemble was called Schola Cantorum on Hudson, now rebranded as Ember Ensemble. It was a really spectacular experience. And like I said, that first year teaching, after my first semester of teaching, I thought, oh my gosh, my spirit needs to sing because there is some dissonance going on and some discord that I just cannot work through on my own. And so then, yeah, we reconnected, and I suppose the rest is history.
You kind of found a family with us.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's what that group really does so very well, and continues to. And you reconnected with them this past summer when you conducted them at my wedding.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, that was a great time.
Gosh, you still owe me for that one. Conducting on a boat, that was a rich experience.
That was a lot of fun, yeah. But, you know, that's a group, because it's been together so long, and it's not like it's all the same singers all the time. It does, you know, people come and go and so forth. But there's a longevity to that ensemble. And those of us in that group, because we've been together so long, we live life together through music so easily. Mm-hmm. It's like whatever anybody's going through, we all experience and live through music, and oftentimes talk about it in addition to singing about it. And that brings up another difference with choral music, and that is words, very simply words. And it's not to say that you have to have words to be expressive. Of course not. Music itself has its own expressive essence, whether words are there or not. But the fact that words are there almost all the time that we sing gives us something else to hang our hat on and to dialogue through. And this group spends a good bit of time really thinking through poetry together. And we learned more about each other's nightmares through one particular piece we did this past concert than I ever thought we would. So it does draw us together more.
Yeah, choir very easily becomes group therapy.
Very
right?
definitely.
Yeah, and again, just thinking about this idea of choir as this social equalizer or democracy in action, the fact that you do have words, yes, that certainly doesn't put us above any other sort of music making, but it does give a sort of accessibility into artful conversation that could be challenging in a context where you don't have words to anchor your conversation. Sure. Right. And then to have the joy of digging into that text and that poetry with your colleagues in the ensemble or with your conductor mm-hmm. and saying, well, you know, through the lens of my life, this is what this piece means to me. And through the lens of your life, wow, I never would have thought to see the world that way. And what a beautiful idea. Mm-hmm. You're offering us as we sing shoulder to shoulder and breathe out together and breathe in together and our hearts start to sync up. And, you know, there's just something so magical about what we do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we talked a little bit about Schola Cantorum on Hudson, and I'd like to bring us back to that. I think this is a good time to talk about the organization that you founded. How long has it been, Deborah? How long ago did you found Schola Cantorum on Hudson now?
25 years ago.
Gosh, wow. So, I mean, your baby is like off in the world doing its thing.
That's right.
It's truly an amazing organization, three prongs to it, and it's seen various iterations over time. But correct me if I'm wrong, as I currently understand it, there are three sort of facets to the organization. There's the Ember Ensemble, which is your professional amateur ensemble that performs very regularly in both Manhattan and New Jersey. There is your Schola Phoenix Singers Initiative that helps to connect high school singers to high quality choral experience. And then there's also Project Encore, which my students have tons of questions about. And I think it's a great space for us to spend some time after we sort of get an overarching idea of what the Schola Cantorum on Hudson organization does. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, it's 25 years old. We started out just as, I think, a little better than average community chorus, but it has certainly grown way beyond that. We started out life just in Jersey, but somewhere along the way, I guess first decade of this century, we began doing all of our concerts in Manhattan as well as in New Jersey. And now we actually rehearse in Manhattan because more of our singers come from Manhattan than from New Jersey. We rehearse in the Opera America building, except for right now when we're rehearsing in our Zoom room.
Yeah. So how's it been for your singers? How are you and your singers coping with the current pandemic? We know, you know, our hearts go out to you in New York and New Jersey, because we know that's really the epicenter of this pandemic in the United States. So how are you doing? How are your singers doing? And how are you staying connected with choral music?
I've not yet missed a rehearsal, either with Ember or with the Church Bunch. We're all staying active. It certainly is very different rehearsing with a choir that you cannot hear.
they've never sounded better.
Well, that's what they tell me. They tell me that they are really just spot on with all of it. Yeah. But I think, you know, if we look at a typical rehearsal, a normal times rehearsal, and we come together in a room and we interact in a variety of ways, we're there to make music. There's no doubt about it. We're there to take care of business, get our music learned, and to do it at a high level so that we can communicate among ourselves and hopefully be of value in the community when we take our art to share with others. So I'd say that a normal rehearsal, it's like 80-85% getting the work done. You know, it's musical. Mm-hmm. And the rest, certainly social and emotional. I see that completely flipped in our current, you know, our Zoom room rehearsals. The need for community right now is very strong. People who sing together just do bond together. That's just the way it is. You just don't sing together and not have that happen. And so when we knew we couldn't meet together in person any longer, it was absolutely clear to me that we needed to figure out something. And I didn't know anything about Zoom. I thought, well, are we going to Skype? And how many people can FaceTime take? And, you know, so looking all around. And of course, the choral community is absolutely fabulous. And I reached out to Christy at Chorus America and worked with Jacob and Tori at Chorus Connection, people who are, you know, in leadership in terms of support of choirs all around the country, and said, what's going on? What are we doing about this? What are some mechanisms? You know, And one of the hats I'm privileged to wear is that of chair of the New York Choral Consortium. And of course, we were reaching out to our own singers. What are you trying? And here are some things to try. And before you know it, everybody's on Zoom. And boy, did I feel like I didn't know what I was doing initially. And I guess I still sort of don't, but we're getting into patterns. We'll pick a piece and we'll go through a section. I have to ask them what they need after that. How did that go? Do you need some of that again? And they'll say, yeah, if we could go back to measure 57, that'd be great. You know, whatever. So we work at it together.
Something that I find to be really inspiring and beautiful is the amount of crowdsourcing and collaborating that we're doing. You talked about this with the New York Choral Consortium and getting your own choir started up on Zoom, for example. You know, we don't necessarily know these technologies. We certainly to date were not taught them in our college training experiences. Even, you know, you're laughing because there's an age gap here, but even I, in my teaching experience or teacher training experience, did not receive this kind of education. And so we're having to phone in to this network that we've built up over time and say, please help, mm-hmm. right? There's something there that conductors are not very good at, which is being humble. and we're having to actually knock on people's doors and say, I don't know how to do this. Can you please help me? And I found that as I'm doing that, or as I see colleagues doing that on Facebook or in talking with you, everybody is so willing to be so generous and supportive right now and just share their secret sauce, whatever that might be, so that we all can succeed in singing together.
Mm-hmm. I think we have potentially quite a few wonderful takeaways from this time.
Well, there's lots of questions, too, that my students have about programming and performance. And I would love to talk a little bit specifically about Project Encore and how you program repertoire. I'll frame this in the question that my student Jackie asks. And she says, how are the themes for Ember's concert chosen? Having a focus on social awareness through music is inspiring and moving, she says in parentheses. I know you have a very unique brand, just having been so close to you for so long. And I would love for you to talk to me and my students and our listeners about how you program repertoire to be responsive to the world that you find yourself in, to reflect the world, or to move us forward to think of things differently than we have before.
That's a great question. You know, I try to tap into what I feel is going on in the world right now. This season, we call listening. And that's simply in response to the fact that it doesn't seem to be being done very well. And so we've looked at, you know, how do we listen to ourselves? How do we listen to others in our daily lives? How do we listen to people who are different than we are? And we were in our May concert going to be listening to the voices of Earth. And we will be listening to voices of Earth at another time because we're not performing together right now.
Yeah. Well, and I remember from a conversation you and I had recently about that spring concert, you were considering something really drastic or dramatic, which is to pull a piece from the program, right? Because in light of current events, you felt it was inappropriate to perform that piece of repertoire. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's such a big thing to do because this is a commission, which is something that's worth saying as well. So not only is it a commission, but this is something that singers are going to put hours of work into. Then you as the director are faced with the situation of, well, this is what is happening in the world, and this might not be the right piece to offer the world at this time. How did you make that decision?
We have not officially, publicly yet canceled our May concert dates. By the time this airs, we will have canceled / moved. It's pretty clear we will not be performing in public in the middle of May. This group has made the decision to ready itself to sing in public when that becomes a viable option, because we feel like that our world is going to need it. We're not going to be stretching our audiences with a very difficult commission piece. As impactful as it is, this is not the time. We need things that are very directly nurturing, not things that people have to dig a little bit for. You know, another thing that we're thinking about, we are currently programmed to do the first concert in the next season in November, a week and a half after the November election, the national election. I'm looking very carefully at what do we bring forward at that point in time, because our country's nerve endings are going to be, wherever it goes, that's not going to be an easy time sociologically. How do we interface with that as musicians, and particularly with this particular group that has very much a social awareness mission? And I would point out, this is not the same thing as the social justice choir movement, and that's, I honor that. I think it's a great movement, but this is not about convincing others to a cause or bringing forward a cause that we're trying to convince somebody to believe a certain way. It's not that at all. We're trying to bring forward issues that we feel need attention, warrant attention, and hopefully give them some attention in ways that shake us a little bit, make us think about them a little bit. So it's a catalyst to self-exploration or rethinking in some fresh ways.
I'm wondering, as you come up with these programs, not just for one concert, but for an entire season, how much of it is you digging in the dirt and finding the repertoire and seeking it out versus you proclaiming that this is your intention and then just opening yourself up to whatever the universe is going to send your way? Because that, to me as a conductor, sounds terrifying.
It is a balance, and both a balance and a mix, and I separate those two terms. I typically will go into a rehearsal season for a, by which I mean, if we're performing on March 1st, for example, and we start rehearsals right after the new year, referring to that as a rehearsal season. Typically, we'll go into a rehearsal season about 80% programmed. I do not have everything programmed because I need to feel it. I need to feel the flow. I also need to feel, and again, we're talking specifically Ember. I would not do this with, you know, under other conditions, but these are very flexible singers and very generous with their trust in what's going to ultimately emerge. But I need to feel the particular mix of singers. I need to feel the flow of the music. I think I know what it's going to do, but I program very much by energy flow and that in relation to what the message is.
Yeah. And I'll say having sang it in your ensembles, it works. I think something that for me as a teacher and conductor, that's still a growing edge, is knowing timing at which I should share that with my ensemble and how to share that with my ensemble so that they feel fully compelled to buy into it. They're not intimidated by it. They're not rolling their eyes at it. Because I know that in my early teaching career, there are times that I wait until the last minute to sort of reveal the show. And that's no good for anyone. So what sort of advice would you have for conductors and teachers around crafting vision and the timing to share it and how to share it?
Oh, I'm so humbled that you would ask me that, because I'm not sure I have this right. With this particular ensemble, they get the vision right off the bat. You know, I share it with them as best I can. But I think that just as, you know, when I was finding the repertoire and I was conceiving of the concept and the flow and all of that, you know, I was getting it. And so I've been living with it for a good while before they show up for the first rehearsal. And so, you know, I can't assume that they will understand just because I share my vision. And to be completely frank, it's not about my vision. It maybe starts out with that. That's the platform, but then the train comes along and we all get on it and it goes different places sometimes. And so their vision, as they bring that to the fore, is enormously formative in terms of what we come up with. One thing we've been doing more this year than we've done in the past, and I love it, and I think they do too, is I'll step out of the conductor role for a little while. Now, we can't do that on a read-through of a difficult piece, but you know, once a piece is somewhat known, if we seem to get stuck at a certain level, or if perhaps I'm feeling a lag, their responsiveness to gesture or what have you, I find it's time to step aside and say, chairs in a circle. And, you know, it's a big circle, right? You take it. I'll get you started and you take it. And then at a certain point, it'll stop. And you know, well, what happened there? Well, we didn't breathe together here. Well, why not? Well, what are we saying here? No, I think we're saying this. Well, I really saw it this way. And they will dialogue through a certain passage, the poetry of it, the music of it, and how it needs to go. And they need to breathe it together. And they've come up with images such as a flock of birds or a school of fish. You know, they somehow know how to move together after a certain point. And, you know, then my role becomes different.
Yeah, you're facilitating a choral experience rather than having to lead it from the podium, which is something I think we all could use lessons on because we work, honestly, we work so hard to earn that right to be on the podium or to hone the skills it takes to be successful on the podium that it can be so hard to step off of it and to say, you musician who has no, quote unquote, music pedigree, you drive the ship for a while, take the Benz out for a ride and see how you feel about it. But that reminds me of when you said, you know, your rehearsals tend to be 80% or so choral and music rehearsing and 20% social. And I imagine when you say 20% social, that doesn't necessarily mean 20% sitting there kibitzing about whatever you want. It's 20% digging into this poetry, having deep, meaningful conversation, sharing how this piece filters through the lens of your life with each other. So that you can form that flying V or that school of fish swimming through the ocean.
Well, and in all honesty, going to the bar next door afterwards is part of it too.
Listen, you know? It all helps.
You know, they bond. We bond. Yeah. You know, and it's a good. And as I say, this is a little bit unique. You would not be able to do this necessarily on the same level with other organizations. But I do think that there is an element of, you know, how can we encourage whatever level our singers are to engage with their music in ways that engage who they are with the music, and then making that almost a triangle. They engage with each other, they engage with the music, and it's connected. You've got three connected dots, and let them come forward, you know, and the music will shape them and they will shape the music, and we're all richer for it.
When you were talking about programming before, I want to sort of bring us back because I do want to talk about Project Encore. You talked about just the energy flow of a program. And when I hear people say things like that, sometimes I just roll my eyes because I'm like, I don't have the time to think of energy flow. I just need a 40-minute program. But when I hear you say energy flow, one thing that I really value as a contribution that you've given to the world is the Project Encore database, because I can go to that database and I can look up keywords that include feelings or motifs or like philosophical ideas. And it generates for me these new or newer pieces of choral repertoire that I never would have found anywhere else. So as the gift that I see Project Encore offering us is a chance to lean into that energy flow you're talking about. How did you come up with that? And just tell us a little bit more about it.
Okay. Well, kind of with everything else in my life, it emerged organically. I found myself drawn increasingly, I guess, you know, as of maybe 12, 15 years ago, increasingly to working composers, to the newer voices. And that's not to say that I no longer enjoy the classics. I certainly do. But I found myself working more and more with that. And we ended up doing a premiere of a composition. I worked with a composer after the premiere, which went beautifully, trying to get other performances of it. It was really difficult. You know, you're doing a premiere of a composition and you have at least the possibility of getting a headline. But you don't see too many headlines that say, gonna do it again. And so there, an absolutely wonderful work can sit on a shelf gathering dust. And so when this organization, Skolik and Torum on Hudson, was approaching its 15th season, and we were thinking, well, how can we kind of make it a little bit of a to-do of ourselves? What are we really about, and how can we bring that forward and heighten that awareness in our 15th season? I went to the board and I said, let's program a season of, you know, second performances of works that have had a good premiere. And need to live on and haven't yet. And they looked at me like I had three heads, which was the right thing to do. You know, Deborah, unknown composers, unknown pieces, a season, you know, really, how are we going to sell the tickets? We settled on weaving that second performance concept as a thread through the season. They could deal with that. I could deal with that. Except then I went home and I thought, what have I done? I've created a real problem here. And then I realized if I was really serious about this and going to find wonderful works that have had a successful premiere and really deserve a future life in the choral canon, that research needs to be, the results of that research need to be made known to other people, for one thing. And for another thing, obviously I'm going to come up with a lot more than I could possibly include as a thread through one season. So that got me thinking about how can we do that? And I had some wonderful people on the board with some technology skills and very good at thinking through things in terms of process. And we knew a couple of things right off the bat. One is that it needed to be manageable because, you know, we're a little nonprofit. We don't have big bucks to put behind this. So we couldn't be just inundated, you know, with scores. We didn't want it to be a situation where a composer could empty their bottom drawer, you know, into the, you know. So that's where we said, okay, one work per quarter that a composer could submit. The other thing is we definitely wanted there to be a very tight quality control. And so we were very fortunate when I've handpicked our reviewers, but we have major name individuals who are reviewers for Project Encore. They must not be a composer or an arranger. They need to be a conductor who has who's substantially committed to new music. So their programming shows that and works at a high level. So that describes all of our reviewers. They are anonymous and they will remain anonymous. And both our reviewers and our submitting composers say, yeah, please keep that in place. But they are wonderful individuals and do a great job for us pro bono. And we typically have anywhere between 12 and 25 scores submitted in a quarter. And how much there is oftentimes has to do with, have I been to some conference and done a talk on it or, you know, whatever. But we have a regular flow come through. And then the scores are divided up among our reviewers, and every score is looked at by three of these reviewers. If it gets two or three thumbs up, it goes in the catalog. If it gets one or none, it does not. And it's a serious vetting. We take, it's around 50% of the score. Sometimes it's a little less, sometimes it's a little bit more, but it's not at all a fait accompli that a score will go in. And it's interesting. I don't know who the scores are being sent by. Once the decisions are made, then I'm notified, but I don't know before that. And that's very deliberate because we want to have not only complete transparency in the process and credibility, but we also want to have the appearance also reflect that complete credibility. So I don't know, you know, until after the reviewers have done their work, what's going in that quarter.
So as you're talking about Project Encore, I do want to bring in another question from one of my students, which is, how has Project Encore changed and affected your life? And let's extend that to, say, the world of conductors and composers as well. What do you see the impact of Project Encore being on the choral community?
Project Encore, you know, we saw, well, there's a way to not only help composers get things out of their, you know, off the dusty shelf for a second performance, and hopefully into the choral canon, get additional circulation, but also help conductors find music that has been vetted. It's not just because this composer says, I'm really good. And so vetted with people who have earned the respect of the choral community, it's a great benefit to conductors. They're a little bit behind composers in terms of learning about it, simply because obviously the product had to come from composers. More in the composer community know about it, I think, than in the conductor community. But conductors are learning. The fact that we have a monthly column in the Choral Journal devoted to Project Encore has helped enormously. Shout out to ACDA for promoting the interests of composers.
So let's do a little bit of listening. The first piece you brought with you today is called Final Litany by Wayne Eastwood. And we're going to listen to an excerpt from the 10th movement, Blood to Wash, featuring soloist Gilberto Gomez. And just to share a little bit about who Wayne Eastwood is, American composer, contemporary living composer from Arkansas originally. Does he live there now, Deborah? You would know that.
No, he's in Springfield, Ohio.
Living in Ohio, finished his PhD at University of North Texas. And I'm curious, is that where you met him?
It is. We go all the way back to our PhD work together. I think the text is fascinating and rather astounding, actually, and the music expresses it with such power. And the libretto comes from a combination of writings by inmates on death row, from the Book of Common Prayer, from the Bible, from Emily Dickinson poetry, and a hymn. And they take the piece overall takes the listener, takes the singer on a journey and is very expressive of the thoughts that these inmates experienced while they were in prison. The composer, Wayne Eastwood, had the opportunity of working with them directly. He was
working with
the inmates. Wow. I believe he was teaching reading skills and maybe some other basic life skills. So he knew them. And we see throughout the score often little notes about, you know, we'll just have their initials. We don't know their names. Yeah. We just have their initials. And like DG was sentenced and put to death on such and such. Yeah. You know, I mean, you hear the tough stuff. And it's a marvelous mix of difficult realities and reflections on those difficult realities. The score overall is for a very small chamber ensemble. It calls for cello, clarinet, piano, and timpani. It does call for some pretty heavy-duty soloists. You have to have a good baritone, and you will hear that in the 10th movement, Blood to Wash. And it was written by a man who was executed for a double murder. You know, blood to wash, blood to defile, blood to save, blood to condemn, and so forth. Very, very powerful for baritone or bass and timpani. So it's a very powerful work. Right after that is a stunning and, in my opinion, very extractable little tiny single movement on a Dickinson text, I Died for Beauty. It's absolutely stunning.
What an interesting concept to take these texts from inmates who the composer interacted with and to elevate them not only by setting them to music, but also putting them alongside one of the greatest American poets,
absolutely,
Emily Dickinson. Mm-hmm. It's such a compelling narrative that Wayne Eastwood is telling here. And, you know, he denotes it as a cantata.
Yes.
Right. So it's this large choral dramatic work that tells an arc from beginning to end, as you said, about the story of an inmate being sentenced to death and draws upon texts from death row inmates. And what I think is so powerful about this is that Wayne Eastwood, by elevating these texts, by setting these texts to music, is saying these humans have something to tell us about our condition, about our experiences that we can all learn from, that we can all be inspired from. And then we as singers all of a sudden have to put on the costume of that character, right? That I am singing these words as though I were an inmate. How does that feel in my body? How do I move differently in the world for those moments? I think it encourages a level of empathy that I just wouldn't get from reading a New York Times article about an incarcerated inmate.
Well, and there's some real wisdom in some of these words. It's not just powerful, gut-wrenching, you know, thoughts. It's also some real insight.
The second recording you brought along with you today is also from a larger work for chorus and orchestra called Se Go La by contemporary American composer Andrea Clairfield. Let's listen to an excerpt from inside the beautiful St. Paul the Apostle Church in New York City, featuring Skola Cantorum on Hudson under your direction. All right, so Se Go La, I also sang with you while I was a singer in Skola Cantorum on Hudson, was featured on that 10th anniversary season right. of 9/11. And it was sort of the capstone concert mm-hmm. of that season, the culminating concert of that season. So tell us a little bit about this work okay. and what makes it
the
so
work
important.
Initially was written for very large chorus, very large children's chorus, and huge orchestra. But I was absolutely captivated by it when I heard it. And actually, Andrea started talking with me about it several years before it was performed. So I had an expectation going to the premiere performance, which was done by the Mendelssohn Club under the direction of Alan Harler, shout out. And I was just astonished by its statements. And it has many statements. What we ended up doing was doing the premiere of a chamber rescoring because we're much smaller. I think we had maybe 33, 34 and a much smaller chamber ensemble in support. But part of that small chamber ensemble was about 5 miles of percussion. It's absolutely rich yeah. in percussion and fabulously so.
And included some really interesting Tibetan instruments as well. Not just your standard orchestral
oh, yeah.
percussion section.
The various I know the tenor section played singing bowls at a certain point, and there were all kinds of things that that we engaged with in addition to the three percussionists who were very busy the entire concert. In short, Andrea, along with an anthropologist by the name of Sienna Craig, trekked to the remote Tibetan area of Lomontang, and an area in which the actual culture has avoided occupation. And so the culture itself is still fairly pristine. It's also probably nearing its extinction. And she and Sienna went and recorded over 130 songs. Yeah, some
wow.
of them court songs, some of them folk songs. But wanting to collect them and preserve them for posterity. And of course, because electronics were available, not what we have today, they didn't exactly Zoom room in, but they took a little cassette player and many batteries and recorded these people themselves playing and singing their folk songs. And I believe she has actually been able to make a collection of these songs. I don't know if they're published yet or not, but she used some of that material as the basis for this work, Se Go La. Tsegula actually means thresholds, more expansively, thresholds of this life. We did one of our concerts on a Western concept of life and death, and we did Christlag und Todesband and Bach for that and surrounded that with other works. A more Eastern perspective on life and death sees not clear lines, but sees thresholds within a single process. So before we enter our life on this earth, we are alive. And then we go through the threshold that is birth and come into this life, and we interact with this world. And then we go through the threshold that is our entrance into the life beyond this earth. It's a very different perspective, different spiritual perspective. And that's what this cantata seeks to bring forward.
Yeah, and in fact, the cantata is structured that way. It starts with that first threshold in the first movement of birth, and then ends with the entering or passing through the last threshold, death. And it's split into six movements and is meant to be performed as one continuous piece, correct?
Yes. Having said which, the one movement for just treble chorus has been excerpted and is available as and it's a fun little movement for treble voices, three-part treble voices. Okay. And that they dance with that, and it's a fun movement. There also is one of the instruments in the piece, in the scoring, is an electronic soundtrack of sounds derived from these elements as Andrea recorded them when she was in the Lomontong area. So it's fascinating composition, not easy to do well, but very much worth it.
Yeah, I think from looking at Andrea's website, it's been performed 3 or 4 times, maybe. It's a bear of a piece, but so worth the effort.
Absolutely
put into
is.
It.
Yeah. But it is very effective. Very effective.
Yeah, I remember performing this piece, and I'll actually say, you know, I saw Andrea recently at an ACDA gathering. So greetings to Andrea Clearfield, if you're listening out there. It was wonderful to connect with you again. This is one of the pieces that helped me get into graduate school. I remember I was auditioning for various schools around the country, and one of the schools, part of their entrance process was to choose a piece of repertoire that was particularly impactful and significant to you. And this is, at the time I was applying for graduate school, I had only a year or so prior performed this piece with you, and I was just so changed by experiencing it, because it was so unlike any other choral piece I had heard or been a part of before. And so it got me into Boston University, which is awesome. I didn't end up going there. You know, the University of Minnesota, SCIUMA, is where I ended up doing my graduate studies. But at that time, it was a very influential and significant piece for me. And I very sincerely thank you for the opportunity to sing it, because it just totally broadened my horizon in terms of what this medium can do and what it can be. As we, you know, Andrea gathered all of these ethnomusicological recordings and found ways to weave them in a really beautiful way that honors the culture of Tibetan people. It shows a profound appreciation for that culture rather than a robbing of that culture. And I you know, she has some videos on her website of the Tibetan people that she got these field recordings from listening to the music that she composed. And she talks about how extraordinary their reactions were and how they perceived it as a meeting of their worlds, a bridge between the East and West. And they were really honored by the work that she did. And it just sort of exploded my mind, and I wanted to do more.
Yeah. Well, she is brilliant. I mean, Andrea is just brilliant and a dear friend.
Well, to wrap up our time together, Deborah, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the podcast, these questions, or many of the questions that I've been asking you today, have been generated by my students at North Hennepin Community College. And one of my students, Isaiah, I thought asked a really wonderful question, because you are quite the accomplished woman. I know that from having the privilege of being your friend and colleague and knowing you in real life. My students sense that as they read your bio and see just the enormous list of activities that you fill your days with. And so Isaiah asks, having done so much in the music world, what kind of goal or goals do you set for yourself now to continue to grow? Or do you feel like you have accomplished what you set out to do? So thinking about legacy and that question, Deborah, What sort of answer do you have for Isaiah?
Well, Isaiah, you ask a terrific question, and it's such a terrific question that I'm not sure I have an adequate answer. But I will share some perspective with you. I don't ever, I guess, look at establishing a goal that I have to meet or feel unsuccessful if I don't. My goals have to do with making a difference in lives. And so if there is a legacy of which I hope someday to be most proud, or actually I am most proud, it's that I've made a difference in some lives. And so it lives in the hearts of people whose paths I've been fortunate to cross. And I consider each one of those intersections of lives a blessing, certainly in my life, and hopefully as much in theirs. In terms of tangible, what are we going to leave behind, sort of legacy thoughts, probably Project Encore is the one that that will live on, you know, beyond me. In terms of continuing growth, I think intersecting, again, the lives of many individuals is informative of my own growth, continuing growth. Also, my time that I set aside, that I refer to as my meditation time, my spiritual time, that's where a big part of where I find my growth. And I would encourage everybody, not just musicians, but particularly musicians, because our vehicle is a spiritual vehicle. You know, it lives on the spirit, it lives on the breath, and it speaks from our essence of who we are as individuals. Find that time for yourself each day, even if it's only 10 minutes, but give yourself every now and then the luxury of more, where you're going to read something that maybe nurtures you, where you're going to journal, not sorts of things like I went to the grocery store today, but I wasn't quite sure how I felt about this, but I need to think about it some more. Do your own internal exploration. Those to me are the best means of growth. And of course, I always look for new scores, and I always start with Project Encore.
Yeah. Well, you know, Deborah, you talked about one of your legacies being making a difference in some lives. And I can say from my perspective, you have certainly made a huge difference in mine. And I would not be the musician or the person I am today without you being in my life. So I am so grateful for you. And I could not think of a better first guest for my very first podcast, Keep Calm and Choir On. Thank you, Deborah, so much for spending your time with us. I hope to talk to you soon.
It's a pleasure, and I'm sure we will.
Thanks again to my dear friend, colleague, and mentor, Dr. Deborah Simkin King, for talking with us today. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to this inaugural episode of Keep Calm and Choir On. To learn more about Deborah, you can visit her website, deborahsking.com, or if you'd like to peruse the Project Encore database, you can do so at projectencore.org. A special thanks to Christina Rodel-Sorum, co-host of the podcast Art More Lovely, for her help with editing this episode. And a shout out to my alma mater, Westminster Choir College, for the intro and incidental music. To hear the latest from Keep Calm and Choir On, visit our website at choiron.buzzsprout.com.